Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. The number of people diagnosed with diabetes worldwide has climbed from 108 million in 1980 to more than 422 million today. New research shows that obesity isn't the only reason. Dr. Lubna Munshi is an endocrinologist and diabetes expert at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Ann. Thank you so much.
What does it mean to have diabetes? What is the condition that we're talking about?
So it's more, I would say, in today's world, I tell my patients it's more like lifestyle change now. Because as you say, we have 13% of the population in Ohio, which is diabetic, and almost 35% of them are pre-diabetic. So we know it's a big chunk of people. The main cause is that your pancreas is supposed to make insulin when you eat, mm-hmm. and the sugar rushes in the body and gets absorbed.
Okay.
And the insulin is supposed to get rid of it and pack it up. But what happens, your body, there are two types. Either is not making enough insulin, or it's not, whatever it's making is not kind of reacting the way it is. There's a lot of resistance.
Okay, it's not good insulin.
It is making, but the tissues are not responding.
Okay.
That comes in part with the obesity, because obesity makes a person to be insulin resistant. So the one where they don't make enough is a typically different type 1
that's
diabetes.
That's the type 1 diabetes.
Correct.
When you don't make enough insulin.
And that starts pretty young. It can start in the teens and the tens, and mm-hmm. they have to be on insulin lifelong. Mm-hmm. It can be autoimmune, but nowadays we are seeing a lot when we have pancreatic problems like chronic pancreatitis or chronic alcoholism, where the pancreas is completely destroyed or something. We call that diabetes secondary to pancreatic insufficiency. But the main one, which is the bulk, is the type 2, which we see in and out. Our friends, our neighbors, it's everywhere. Is that you make enough, but it's the body is so resistant to it that it doesn't respond well.
Why is it that obesity makes the body, or can make the body, resistant to insulin?
This is a good question. In fact, there are a couple of theories. The most popular one that we know is fat tissues make a lot of inflammatory markers, which kind of go ahead and make you feel like stressed, and they kind of don't let the insulin work well.
Okay.
There are a couple of new researches which is going on and which show, which was in the article that I just got, is like there's a lot of changes in the biome, in the gut, which mm-hmm. happens when you're obese and we are not. A lot of inflammatory markers go up and down, but that part is still naive. We have animal studies we don't have. The most is that the way the a lot of small inflammatory cytokines are produced, which make your body not respond well to this insulin. And that's all because of this fat tissue. There's a lot of ketosis, a breakdown, and all this adds to that. So in general, anybody who is obese from the beginning, or has a family history, or has gestational diabetes, are prone to have type 2 diabetes in the long run. So what we tell our patients is, if you have a BMI of more than 25, but 23 in case of Asians, if you had gestational diabetes or you're hypertensive, going to your primary care and getting yourself checked annually is what is needed, and you should be checked. Otherwise, if you don't have risk factors, usually the screening starts at 45. But what we see these days, there's a trend that usually we would see type 2 diabetes in the 50s and 60s. Now it has slid down. We do get type 2 diabetes in the 20s and 30s.
And we see it in the 50s and 60s because that's when people start packing on the pounds.
Correct. The basal metabolic rate kind of slows
metabolism
down.
Metabolism slows down, right.
And so they don't, whatever they eat, they just, most of it is packed rather than used. It also is what I see, because I trained in India, then I trained here, there's a difference in cultures what I see. Mm. The big factor, I think, that plays in U.S., because we top the chart in obesity and type 2 diabetes.
In the U.S.,
Yes, is portion size, is portion control and carb control. Till now, we would always blame cholesterol and everything. But I think sugars, diet control, portion control from the beginning is huge. And we lack that here in even for kids' meals. If you see the menus, it's huge. That I think, plays a big role, and we are building up this epidemic. As you said, it's almost 400 million. We don't know what's going to be in a decade.
Now, obviously, there's more people, too. Didn't look at a percentage in that score. We were just looking at raw numbers. All things being equal, though, given all of our advanced knowledge and how the increasing level of knowledge we have about it, we know what most of it's coming not from type 1. Most of the increase is coming from type 2.
Yes, from the type 2.
That's a salient point. New research shows that obesity isn't the sole cause of diabetes or type 1. A study published earlier this year linked positive traits like optimism to a reduced risk of diabetes. Low optimism, high negativity, and hostility were associated with increased risk. Those are just correlations. Those aren't causations, are they, or what?
They have a little point in there. Okay. So whenever a body is stressed, any kind of stressed, when you're not at ease, your cortisol level go up. Your cortisol level is supposed to be up in the morning.
And cortisol is?
It comes from the adrenals. It's like your stress hormone.
Gotcha.
That's why we check all these levels in the mornings, because you're, as per the human nature, by evolution, you're supposed to be up and about, going up to do your chores, like ancient man hunting in the mornings. Mm-hmm. And they're minimal at night. When stress comes in, when you're worked up, you don't get enough sleep, you don't eat proper, you have timelines and date sheets, your stress level is high. Though that brings up your cortisol level, and that makes your sugars go high. It's like it's pushing you to do extra.
And then when your sugar's high, it's putting extra stress and more demand on the insulin and the pancreas.
And it's called the catecholamines. It's not like you're eating more. It's just that your body is under such a stress. That's why these factors have shown to play a part. There are studies in animals which show some autoimmunity, some immune system responses. But there were studies like on this paper, they were showing that post-bariatric surgery, the IgA levels in mice and the stools from this mice who had this or humans who had that, that levels increased. And we don't know how these IgA levels in the gut affect the biome or the bacterial growth in the colon and how it plays as a role overall with obesity and insulin resistance. But having a good lifestyle is the best. Yes, obesity, not only if somebody is an offspring of a mom who was obese or had gestational diabetes, there's an extra risk. So it's not that the child has to be obese. All these factors play a part in having you a little at the edge of having type 2 diabetes.
And I guess, you know, you and I were talking off the air earlier, when we talk about the idea that diabetes can start in the womb, that a fetus can show signs of diabetes, that could be a couple different things. That could be type 1, which is what they're maybe inherited. It also could be they're inheriting the well-being of the mother.
Right. So there, as we said, there was a study that done long back, but it did show if you have a mom who's under stress and during that conception and those babies born later, like in a famine area long back or a war zone and those babies born later. But those are a couple of studies. Those are not that we can say in the general population. We need more research on that. But yes, gestational diabetes, having PCOS in the mom, or being diabetic from before conception and not having your levels under control puts a bigger burden that we can see and have evidence about.
Newborns aren't routinely checked for.
Oh, yeah.
They are.
They are checked for,
All kinds of stuff. I just have no idea.
It's a gazillion.
Out of my mind.
It's a train of genetics testing that is done. Blood sugar, if you see all the babies have heels poked, that comes part of it. Especially when the mom is labeled pre-diabetic or gestational, then the chances of getting them checked is even more.
Okay.
Because we know there's a transfer. They're prone to low sugars immediately after birth if the mom is diabetic because there's a little cross-placental transfer. So, yes, babies are screened, especially in this part of the world, they're screened pretty well.
Okay.
Pretty well. And on their pediatric checkups also, they do measure everything. If a baby is more than 8-9 pounds, the trigger goes up and they definitely screen more.
Oh, okay. As far as the cause of type 1 diabetes, it's the pancreas is not producing enough insulin.
Right.
Has anyone tried to cure that? I know you get insulin shots if you have diabetes,
correct,
but what about going to the heart of the problem? Why is that?
So there's research still going on, and we do have something called islet cell transplant, and we have a pancreatic transplant. So what happens in type 1, it's autoimmune. That means your body is making antibodies, like kind of stuff that destroys your own pancreas. So you don't have the pancreatic B cells, which are supposed to make this insulin.
Mm-hmm.
You just are deficient in it. So you need the insulin from outside. And since the invention or discovery of insulin, life changed. Those kids would die of, just totally die of starvation. They wouldn't just be led there. But insulin revolutionized. Now people live with 50 years, 60 years plus of type 1 because we have insulin. The latest studies that are happening, we are trying to find out why. We know that it's autoimmune. Now, how do we fix it? So we try to take these islet cells and try to insert them back and see if they develop, or there's the new, what we are mostly doing is the pancreatic transplant. Huh. We have many patients who had the pancreatic solo transplant or pancreatic and kidney transplant, and they have been off insulin. I recently had a patient, and the same miracle. I mean, she has been off the insulin for 9 years post this kidney pancreatic transplant, and she was type 1. It's a new life for her.
So much, you know, you say we know it's autoimmune. So much of the program these days, it seems like, goes back to autoimmune issues and gut biome.
Correct.
And it's like this universe of questions out there.
It is huge. It's we don't know, although there's a lot of research going on that, we don't know technically the trigger factors. What triggers it?
Tipping points, that kind of thing.
Right, like the tipping point that we could just catch and hold it there. But we are more working on the betterment, the detections, and the improvement and treatment part of it. Maybe we are at the horizon, we can find out what is the trigger. But so far, I know more in case of type 2 diabetes, we have those points that we try to look. For example, if somebody is pre-diabetic, there was a study done in China which ran a long time, and it showed that if you lose weight and you change lifestyle, you're going to push this pre-diabetes to becoming diabetes for a while. It's like pre-diabetes is like a warning signal that a storm is coming, do something. It's like preparing for your storm. It's not that you just ignore it. Okay, I'm pre-diabetic. I'm not diabetic yet. Big deal.
Mm-hmm.
That part is more understood well and working on rather than type 1. Type 1 is more with pancreas only.
Speaking of a storm is coming, the number of people diagnosed with diabetes is expected to rise from, what did I say it was, at 422 million today. It's supposed to rise by more than 200 million throughout the next decade.
Correct.
Some experts say it will be the worst epidemic the world has ever seen.
In my eyes, yes. I also see it that way because the way we see patients and the trend that I said, youngsters are more coming into it. Childhood obesity and childhood type 2 diabetes is huge. And it's like a tip of an iceberg. When it's going to surface, it's going to be an epidemic for sure. It needs to be curbed, and the curb, I would say, following up your annual exams with your PCP, not missing them, because for sure primary cares do a great job. They do their screenings.
Mm-hmm.
They pick up those risk factors, and primary cares are everywhere, like a web in the society. Specialist and tertiary care centers are few. People don't need to see a specialist. A primary care can screen them annually, as I said, for high-risk patients early on starting. We can grab them and we can start treatment and help them out with losing weight, starting some metformin, basic pills, rather than letting it blow up into an epidemic. And when you get hooked up, you can get an idea and education about what to avoid, what to do, what is your steps. There are so many resources. Just simple having a Fitbit or a watch that tracks your steps, mm-hmm, gave so many people motivation to cross that 10,000 steps a day. It makes you feel a lousy person when you don't get even 1,000 a day. You feel bad. So I think those little things are big. And the community has to I have an example. When I had a parent teacher meet with my kid, every parent was asking, they were good in math and science. I just told the teacher, could you tell them to eat healthy? It's the start. They listen to you more than they listen to me.
Uh-huh.
Because snack time is a problem. It's always junk food. So starting from grassroots levels, following your primary care and making these steps is going to help us kind of keep this in the bubble rather than letting it blow out of control, the epidemic of type 2 diabetes and obesity.
Dr. Lubna Moonshi, thank you so much for your time today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Anne. I always listen to you. So you're my Wednesday traffic buddy.
Thank you. That's Dr. Lubna Moonshi. She's an endocrinologist and diabetes expert at Ohio State University's Wexner Medical Center. We have more Wellness Wednesday coming up. We're going to talk about how to recover from daylight savings time. So stay with me. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
How do you turn what you love into a career? On season 2 of the Rivet podcast from WOSU, hear firsthand from students translating their interests into jobs without college. Listen to This American Graduate Project as we highlight the next generation of workers in the state's top industries of agriculture, insurance, and healthcare. Support for the Rivet podcast series comes from COSI. Subscribe now at wosu.org/rivet, on the WOSU mobile app, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. On Sunday, clocks across the country fell back an hour as daylight savings ended, the latest cycle of daylight savings time. That means sunlight is scarcer. And just because the clock's red one time doesn't mean our bodies won't respond to another. Terry Crawley is a registered nurse, clinical sleep educator, and author of the 2016 book, Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Anne. Thanks for having me back. It's a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you, Terry. How can 1 hour make such a big difference?
Oh, my gosh. It really does. Whether we spring forward or fall back, it's a change in our, you know, sleep patterns, our circadian rhythms, which is, you know, basically our body clocks. So there's an adjustment at both times of the year. And we really have to take some steps to make sure, you know, we're getting through it as best we can, because it can really take a toll on us.
So what is it about the body? I mean, what sort of things have to change for it to adjust to a new sleep schedule?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is, and most of us are sleep deprived to begin with. And when we have these jumps, you know, where we go forward an hour or fall back an hour, we tend not to adapt very easily. And, you know, when it comes to sleep, every little bit counts. I think a lot of us have been, you know, disregarding sleep for too long or not realizing its impact on basically every aspect of our functioning. So we really have to take it seriously, and even small amounts affect us. And, you know, a lot of us, unfortunately, don't take advantage of that extra hour of sleep in the fall. You know, people can, you know, tend to stay up a little bit later or stay out a little bit later. And unfortunately, not everyone gets that benefit of an extra hour of sleep, but it can make a difference. So I think we have to be cautious. We have to be cautious about drowsy driving, both in the fall and the spring. We have to be cautious about, you know, our health and how we're impacted by this. And really, I think it marks a time when we should talk about sleep and its importance, especially with our young children.
Is it easier to spring ahead or fall back?
Well, it's easier to fall back, but I'm sure as many of your listeners may feel it, we can feel the effects either way for, you know, a few days or up to a few weeks, depending on how disrupted your sleep schedule is and how sleep deprived you are at baseline. So, I mean, even though the spring is notoriously more difficult and that 1 hour can make a huge difference, I don't think we should ignore the fall time change either. I mean, it's disruptive. You know, kids can get off schedule pretty easily with just a little bit of change in their schedule. So it's important that we really practice good sleep health habits year-round. I think there are people advocating to get rid of this time change because, you know, there are studies that we have more fatal accidents with the time change. I know there's issues with heart attacks. Some studies have shown the heart attack rate goes up in the spring when we lose the hour, and it may go down in the fall when we gain an hour. But accidents, the rates tend to jump at both times, probably just because of, you know, we've got issues with it's darker earlier in the day, and that can affect our driving and things like that. So again, we just need to really sort of respect the importance of sleep all year round and realize we have to accommodate this and adjust to this and take it seriously.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about sleep health today in honor of the end of daylight savings. My guest is Terry Crawley. She's a registered nurse, clinical sleep educator, and author of the 2016 book, Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. How do you know if you don't get a good night's sleep? Like, you think you've gotten a good night's sleep, but you may not be?
Right. And, you know, sometimes some people are so, you know, sleep deprivation is so common with them that they lose their point of reference and they just sort of stumble through the day and don't realize they really do need more sleep. But I think it can manifest itself in ways other than that sort of sleepy feeling, which a lot of people were, you know, consume a lot of excess caffeine to get through, but just being more irritable, having problems communicating, mood swings, problems with relationships. There are a lot of other ways that sleep deprivation affects us. Cravings for junk food. You know, we just discussed diabetes and obesity. Right. Well, these are parallel epidemics. Sleep deprivation is linked to diabetes and obesity. And
why
not
is
just
that?
In adults. Yeah, it's because sleep deprivation affects hormones, and ghrelin and leptin are two hormones that are very impacted by sleep deprivation, which really affects your metabolism. So we really if we want to address diabetes and obesity, we have to address sleep deprivation. I mean, it's that important to both of those issues. So it's something to take very seriously.
And long-term effects of sleep deprivation?
Lots of health problems. And I mean, even chronic health problems. We can get heart disease from not getting enough sleep. Look at the latest research about dementia and Alzheimer's. You know, that's pretty worrisome that some of these proteins can build up in your brain when you don't get sufficient sleep. So we really have to look at this as a very widespread and very serious public health issue. And I think part of this, you know, our approach to this, Anne, is to start with very young kids and have that discussion about the importance of sleep very early and very often with them and instill good sleep habits early and be role models as adults. You know, we have to practice good sleep habits so our kids pick up on it, but we really have to, you know, have some discipline and maybe stop the binge watching at night or turn off the electronics earlier rather than later and really reap the benefit of sufficient sleep because they're so numerous and so important, not just to our physical health, but to our psychological health as well. We're talking about depression, anxiety, things like that are all attributed to sleep deprivation. So to answer your question, they're lifelong effects. And I think that's why it's important to start early and making sure our children get it in all senses of the word.
There are so many things that go into insomnia, if you want to call it that. How do you define healthy sleep habits? It also has to do with healthy awake habits, right?
Yes, absolutely. And how do you feel when you're awake? I mean, are you really functioning to your full potential and functioning optimally? You know, some people that say, oh, I'm fine on 6 hours or 5 hours, which statistically is pretty difficult and hard to achieve. Most of us need 7 to 9 hours. But really, if you're not getting that and think you're doing okay, try getting a little bit more and see if you do not do better, because a lack of insight into our own performance decrements with lack of sleep is is another issue that comes with lack of sleep. Our prefrontal cortex is affected. So we may think we're doing okay, when in actuality, we're really not. And we're really not performing, you know, to our full potential. So I think people need to, you know, take a step back and say, could things be better? You know, look at our sleep, and sufficient sleep is tied to our ethical, how we handle things ethically, how we love our jobs or not love our jobs. Things like bullying are impacted by insufficient sleep, aggressive behavior. I mean, again, so many aspects of our functioning are impacted by sleep. So I think that really has to be square one in a healthy lifestyle. And that's when, you know, we have to talk to our doctors. Look at, I would say, approach sleep and consider it a vital sign. Talk about sleep at every healthcare provider encounter and address it, because we don't want to let it go too long if it's not good. And if you don't feel great during the day, look at your sleep at night.
You know, it seemed like there was a big surge in using sleeping aids, you know, sleeping pills, prescription sleeping pills. And now I don't know if that's if they're still as popular as they were. What are your thoughts about those?
Absolutely not. In fact, we're looking at these from very, very short-term use. Yes, there's some applications. But in the long term, we're looking at healthy sleep habits and something called cognitive behavioral therapy. And specifically, there's something called CBTI, which is cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. And it's a very effective program that really teaches people to rethink their, you know, about sleep, rethink their habits, develop better and adopt better habits about sleep. And it's actually been shown to be more effective in many cases than any kind of medication. So, and that's available in individual settings, group settings, and online as well. And when we talk about, you know, good sleep habits and the daylight saving time shift, light therapy in the morning is something that's effective and being used, probably more so than medications. Getting natural bright light in the morning is super important. And some people are now using light boxes. Depending where you are living in the country, you know, when it gets dark earlier and stays dark, you know, we've got these long nights ahead of us. We want to avoid that seasonal depression that can sometimes rear its ugly head. So these things, again, it's important to always address sleep with every healthcare provider encounter.
You know, one of the subsets of humans out there that suffer the most are new moms.
Yes. Yes. Don't take it lightly. Try to get help. I think some of us are isolated. We don't have that, you know, pool of relatives nearby to help as much as we used to back in the years when we're, you know, families were extended and lived all, you know, in close proximity. And don't take it lightly, because sleep deprivation can be quite dangerous. And I think people, you know, assume they have some better sense of control over sleep. They have power over sleep, when in actuality, they don't. Don't drive drowsy. It's just as dangerous as driving drunk. But too many of us don't think of it that way. And actually, there's some really great information on the National Sleep Foundation website about drowsy driving, because this week is Drowsy Driving Prevention Week.
I didn't know that.
And Yes. And I think it's important that people realize just how dangerous it is. And, you know, it's definitely something to be very careful of and to be aware, and especially with our teens who are new drivers. Teens are also actually, many of them are very sleep deprived because of the early, very early start times that they have with their high schools. They're new drivers, so they need a lot of good information about that.
Do you have strong feelings about start time for school for teens?
I do. Definitely a public health issue. We're not coddling our teens by being aware of this. We're actually protecting their health. Again, we get back to drowsy driving, crashes, diabetes, obesity, hypertension. These things are rearing their ugly heads in teens because they don't get enough sleep. And It's not always a matter of discipline. Their biology changes with puberty, and they don't have that melatonin production until later in the night. So they tend to fall asleep later and want to sleep later. But we really have to, as adults, protect the sleep of everyone, especially our children. And if, you know, teens get the sleep they need, they're healthier, they learn better, and they have, you know, better psychological health and fewer mental health issues, and they're safer. So that really means it has to be our priority. And we have to just have healthy start times across the board.
What about wakeful young children that get up mm-hmm. a lot during the night? What do we know about why that is?
Well, you know, children have different, you know, biology, and children have different sleep patterns. They do need a lot of sleep. But we also have to, again, really kind of reframe sleep for kids, young kids. Look at sleep as a great big timeout sometimes, depending on their age. And we have to approach sleep in a positive light. And again, to reiterate, that means they need to have knowledge about sleep. And I think young children can grasp that just as much as they grasp why vegetables are good for them. But we have to make that part of their early education, and we have to address it and say, this is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. And don't use going to bed early
as a
reward for kids.
As a punishment.
As a punishment. And don't make staying up late as a reward. You know, let's look at it as something, this is for your health. We all do it. We'll make bedtime a positive time, make bedtime, you know, a wonderful bonding time, and just, you know, look at it as something that's non-negotiable, but it's something we all do to have, you know, better health and to be happier people.
Our world is just more stressful, though. Is that where the cognitive behavioral changes can come into play, or practices can come into play, just to counteract that?
Absolutely. But, you know, sufficient sleep counteracts stress, too, which is something we have to keep in mind. You know, it's sort of a bidirectional thing. The less sleep we get, the less resilient we are. And resilience is absolutely impacted by sufficient sleep. So if you want to handle stress better, get sufficient sleep. That's why we really have to say, you know, don't even look at it as I got to undersleep during the week, you know, because of my work schedule, and then I'll try to catch up on the weekends. I say try to get consistent sleep every single night of the week to really, you know, be your best and handle stress better. So, you know, it's sort of what comes first. But I would say by prioritizing sleep every day of the week, make it a personal priority, family priority, priority in the classroom and workplace, we're going to be less stressed, and we'll make better decisions, we'll have a better outlook, and be more motivated to carry it through to more exercise and healthier eating habits if we start with that foundation of better and sufficient sleep.
Terry Crawley, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely, Anne. My pleasure. Take care.
Sweet dreams. Terry Crawley, registered nurse, clinical sleep educator, and author of the 2016 book, Sleeping Your Way to the Top, How to Get the Sleep You Need to Succeed. We have a little bit more Wellness Wednesday coming up, so I hope you'll stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The measles virus can erase the body's immune system memory. That's according to two new studies published last week in the journal Science. They found that even when patients recover, the virus can inflict lasting damage on immune systems. It comes amidst a historic year for measles. 2019 marked the greatest number of measles cases reported in the U.S. in 27 years. Denise Grady is a science reporter for the New York Times. She recently wrote about the new measles research. We'll post a link to that article on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome, Denise Grady.
Thank you.
Let's talk about that outbreak. 2019, the greatest number of cases reported in the U.S. in 27 years. When, where, and how?
There have been scattered outbreaks around the country. There was a big one in New York. Some of them are occurring in communities where people have gotten information that has frightened them, generally misinformation, where people decide not to vaccinate their kids. And measles is so contagious that if there is an outbreak and you have not been vaccinated or you have not had measles and you're exposed, it's almost for sure that you or your child will get it because it's so contagious. There's an estimate that every child who has measles can infect something like 15 to 20 other people, which is a huge number.
Is it contagious because of the way because it's so easy to contact other people with it?
It's spread by coughing and sneezing, and the virus itself can hang around in the air for a couple of hours. So even if the sick person leaves the room and you happen to go in there, you can catch it that way. And that is part of why it's just almost impossible to avoid if there's an outbreak and you haven't been exposed.
I had measles when I was a kid. I was sick, but I didn't get half as sick as my mom did. She caught it from me. But I could still be struggling with immunity issues decades later, right?
The effects in the kids that they are seeing and that these studies seem to point out probably last for a few years.
Okay.
Maybe not beyond that. They're thinking that it's a few years, 3 years, maybe even 5 years for your immunity to get back to what it was before you had the measles, because it kind of erases your body's resistance against things that you had before, and you built up some resistance, and then measles comes and wipes that out, and you've got to get it all back all over again.
So
and
you get all these sicknesses over again, strep throat, that kind of a thing. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Why is that? What do we know about why that happens?
Well, these two studies, this was kind of suspected for a long time that something like this was going on. And then these two studies kind of came along. They were two independent studies, and they kind of nailed down biologically what was going on. So one of the studies looked at antibodies, which are these proteins that your body makes in response to an infection, and they are what fight off that same infection the next time that you get exposed. So one of the studies found that the antibodies that the kids had before they got measles went away after they got measles. They had a bunch of children that they studied before and after they got measles. And the second study did the same thing, looked at those same children before and after they got measles. And that one didn't look at antibodies, but it looked at the cells that make antibodies. And they discovered that after measles, those cells go away, and certain ones that you need to kind of retain this memory, the virus can actually kill.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the measles. My guest is Denise Grady. She's a science reporter for the New York Times. If you have a question or comment about the studies, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You wrote that researchers first noticed a century ago that measles appeared to suppress the immune system. What were they seeing back then?
There was a pediatrician and an immunologist in Europe who noticed that there were kids who had a skin test, like for TB, and it's that kind of test they would give on the skin, that where you would get a big red mark if you had been exposed to TB before. And that kind of reaction to the test is created by your immune system. And so this doctor gave a child the test and before he'd had measles, and it showed positive. This kid had been exposed to TV. And then after the child had measles, the doctor discovered that the kid came up negative on the test. So it was an indication to him that something was going on with the immune system.
You know, it's interesting because we think of the immune, you know, once you become immune to something, you're immune to something.
Yeah.
And it makes me wonder about all kinds of the impact of all kinds of viruses and that sort of thing on the immune system.
They have not seen this strong an effect from any other virus,
except for
the AIDS virus.
Okay.
Because I did ask about that. I wondered exactly the same thing. You know, is this happening with other viruses? And it's not to this degree, because the issue here is it isn't just a short-term thing. I mean, everybody knows that measles, or most people know, I think, that measles itself can be very serious, and the kids can get ear infections and pneumonia, you know, very shortly after they have measles. But what wasn't understood quite as well was that this kind of effect can last for so long.
You wrote that if a person who has received vaccinations for other diseases contracts measles, it may wipe out the protection that those vaccines has provided. Why is that? What do we know?
Because it knocks out those cells that make antibodies. It knocks out the cells that kind of hold that memory that was created by either the vaccine or whatever you were exposed to before. And the people who did this, one of the studies were suggesting that if this happens, that it might make sense to get vaccinated over again to repeat your other vaccines.
But if a person who gets measles means that means that they weren't vaccinated, right? I mean, I'm sure
right. There's
a, yeah. So aren't those the kind of people that would tend not to get other vaccinations, or?
You know, it's hard to know. I don't know if there's any kind of rational rhyme or reason to it. I have heard that there are people who just have not had the measles vaccine, and they may have gone ahead and had other vaccines. So it could happen to them. I'm imagining also that the kids at risk from this could be the very little ones, because they start getting vaccines very early,
mm-hmm.
but they don't get the measles vaccine until they're about a year old.
Huh.
So if you have your infant who has started, you know, I mean, they start with the hepatitis vaccine when the kids are still in the hospital when they're born, and there are others that they start then, but they don't give measles until about a year, because there is some evidence that the measles vaccine just will not work before then.
You know, we're heading into another season. I'm wondering what lessons were learned in New York from the outbreak, and what public health officials are doing there to avoid it next time.
I think the work is just going to be education and trying to convince people that whatever harms they're imagining from the vaccine are just not there. They're just not real. And I think also people need some education about how bad measles is. You know, we have generations now that have never seen it and don't have any memories of it and may not know of anyone who got it. I mean, I had it as a kid. I know people growing up who lost hearing from it. I knew someone else who had encephalitis from measles. It's not, you know, it's not a trivial illness. It's linked, you know, you call it a childhood illness, but of all of them, it's almost in a class by itself, I'd say.
Mm-hmm. And the symptoms of measles, is it just the spots?
No, it's a very high fever usually, and there will be some coughing and sneezing and runny eyes. And in the course of it, kids can kind of worsen and get bad ear infections and pneumonia.
And as far as that, I was kind of wondering how they did this study, how they identified. Did they just look for kids who had not been vaccinated before and who were had a chance of getting measles? Was that how they started it?
There was, yeah, there
is a community in the Netherlands. That's where these kids were. That are they're known as Orthodox Protestants, and for their own religious reasons, they don't believe in vaccinations. And so there were some researchers over there who went there, and although the families didn't believe in vaccination, they were not they weren't opposed to medical research, I guess. So that when the researchers went over and said, "Can we please take blood samples from your kids who have not been vaccinated?" A bunch of them said yes. So they had blood samples from 77 kids who had never had measles, and within the next few months, there was a measles outbreak, and 77 of these kids all got measles. So they were then able to go and take blood for them after they got measles, and that's where that's how they saw all these changes. They saw that they had had a whole kind of array of antibodies to a bunch of different infections before they got sick. And then after the measles, those levels went way down.
Researchers are calling it immune amnesia, and that's not to confuse the issue. The fact is the body has to be infected, right?
Yeah. You've got to sort of...
It's not like you get your memory back. It's like you have to create a new life.
It's kind of like having your hard drive wiped out or something, and then you've got to reboot and reprogram it. And there's risk with that. Every one of these infections, might be worse. You might get sick all over again.
Folks in New York that experienced the outbreak, are they expecting a similar outbreak, despite the education? I mean, there was a lot of outreach. I think I talked to you last year about this.
There has been a lot of outreach. I don't think that they are expecting an outbreak like this again, only because so many people got measles.
Right.
So if you have a lot of kids who've already been exposed, either because they got measles or maybe because they finally got vaccinated, that group may do okay this time.
And is there a season for measles? I say we're heading into it, but I say that kind of it's the winter time. I mean, is there necessarily a season for it?
I don't know the answer to that, although I think whatever the season is, once it gets going, it's not going to stop because it is just so contagious.
And then for people who don't have memories of what it was like before measles vaccine, which, I mean, I remember being a kid and getting it, but, that's just a very isolated experience. What did measles do?
It gave people really high fever, awful spots all over you that sometimes you could have some skin peeling off later. And also, I don't know if you remember this, but it can make your eyes very sensitive to light.
Oh, yes.
So I had it also when I was a kid.
That's right.
And this was long enough ago that the doctors made house calls, and I was sick enough that my mother called the doctor to the house. And if I wanted to watch cartoons on TV, lying on the couch in the living room, I could do that, but they had to pull the blinds down and I had to wear sunglasses.
Right.
And that was kind of the practice back then. And there are, it's not tremendously common, but there are people that can have gotten permanent eye damage from it. And, it's especially true in poorer countries. What we didn't talk about is around the world, there are still 100,000 children a year who die from measles. And in this country, before vaccination came along, there were 400 or 500 kids a year, just in the United States, who died from measles. And around the world, again, back before there was vaccine, there were close to 1 million deaths a year from measles. And there are estimates by the World Health Organization that the vaccine has saved something like 20 million lives since the year 2000.
Denise Grady, thank you so much for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Denise Grady is a science reporter for the New York Times. She has written about a couple new studies published last week in the journal Science that found that even when patients recover from the measles, the virus can inflict lasting damage on their immune systems. We'll have a link to that article on our website at WOSU.org/AllSides. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thank you so much for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.